Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Packers Podcast. My name is Michael Cohen, and I'm here, as always, with Bob McGinn. And the podcast is brought to you by Canada Dunphy. We thank them for their support. Bob, good morning.
Mike, is the rain ever going to leave?
No. It's going to flood our basements.
5 days in a row. This is Wednesday morning.
We're gathering two of every Packer, putting them on a boat.
It's horrible out.
It's pretty gross.
Dank.
Would you rather have snow? I would. I'd like to go skiing.
Mike, we're trying to get to Oakland and Arizona the next 2 weeks, okay? No, I would not rather have snow.
Trying to go
snow.
Home for Christmas, too.
That's right.
We've got an interesting 8 days coming up here, Bob. Double red eye.
Back-to-back red eyes. It's never happened. Let's not even talk about it, okay?
Okay.
It's just too depressing to think about.
No sleep for us coming up, but well, should we start with the Cowboys?
Yeah, let's talk about that victory, 28-7 at Lambeau.
28-7. What jumped out to you first when you went back and watched it again?
The ability of the offensive line to really stymie a good Dallas front and an injured Packer offensive line. Brian Bulaga played a good game.
He did.
I mean, he's up against a couple good young rushers in DeMarcus Lawrence and Randy Gregory, but I don't know, three or three and a half pressures, that's not bad compared to what it could have been.
One sack, right?
Yeah.
And that's about it, yeah. I was impressed. I mean, you look at that group, and there's nobody healthy across the board. Every single one of them has an injury right now.
Bulaga was gimpy, Mike.
Oh, he was. Gimpy in practice, too.
Was he?
A little bit, yeah.
He's hurting, and boy, that was a big thing to have him on the field, and he really did well in the running game. How many did they get? 230 on the ground, and he was stretching those undersized defensive ends, and they were running underneath him to the right. It was impressive.
Speaking of that running game, obviously the resurgence of Lacy was a major storyline. Just to kind of recap a little bit, Lacy struggles at the beginning of the year, has an ankle problem. People wonder if he's overweight. He bounces back with 200-yard games. People think the ship is righted. And then all of a sudden he gets hit with a curfew violation in Detroit. And if you listen to the broadcast, Joe Buck said basically that, you know, his interpretation of it was that Lacy was just downstairs in the lobby or in a conference room somewhere with family and friends, lost track of time. And then he gets benched because of the curfew violation. So people are wondering about his commitment to the team, how focused he is about football. And all of a sudden he comes back with, arguably his best performance of the season.
It was. He broke five tackles. He dragged a bunch of guys. I thought his pass pro was really good. He was motivated. The first play of the game, J.C. Treader gets kind of walked back by Tyrone Crawford, the three-tech. And Lacy could have gone down, could have run right into the back of him. Instead, he plants that foot, cuts left, gains five. It was an 8-yard difference right off the bat. Played well, didn't he?
13 gains of five or more yards. That's pretty good.
It is, out of 24.
24, yep. Right. And obviously he had a couple big negatives. I think he had two minus fives in there. But he ripped off some big ones. And, what was impressive to me, too, is just sort of the emotion that he showed on the field. You know, Lacy is a guy who is going to break tackles, and so his style is more exciting than, just a guy who's going to beat you with speed. And I thought the fact that he was getting up, that he was screaming, yelling, showing emotion, I think, whether conscious or not, I don't know, he was giving indications that, hey, I'm really trying to atone for what I did last week.
So he's surpassed 100 yards three of the last four games.
Yes.
Right.
He's still got an outside chance at 1,000 yards.
What's he got?
Right now? Let's see. So we've got, what, three games left?
Yep.
And he's at 641, so he needs about .120-ish.
Okay, let's see these. Oakland is 12th in run D. Arizona is 5. and the Vikes are 20. So it's not going to be easy.
Not going to be easy, but could happen, I guess.
Yes, it could. McCarthy will try to feed him the ball after this performance.
That's what I think. You know, for as much as he loves and trusts and praises Aaron Rodgers, I just think that with the receivers that this team has and the struggles that are now basically a season's worth of struggles almost, I just don't think it's really going to get fixed, the passing game, in the next couple weeks. Maybe I'm wrong, but I just think the recipe for this particular team in this particular season, no matter how good Aaron Rodgers is to run the ball and set up the play action that way. What do you think? Can the receivers somehow fix it in 3 weeks in the playoffs?
Not to do some of the stuff they really would like to fix it with, but I think with good coaching and good scheming and drawing of stuff and design, I think they can be really good in the air. I've thought that all along. It's just how you use these receivers. Maybe you can't use them in classic ways, but you can do it. How about this Raider run defense, Mike? We're getting to the Raiders later, but Denver, 21 carries, 34 yards. The Chiefs, I mean, they really want to run the ball, 22 for 89. And the week before that, the vaunted Tennessee Titans were 18 for 44.
And remember what Denver did to this Packers team. Shredded them with those stretch plays.
They did.
Over and over. I think they ran for a buck 60, maybe? Mm-hmm. Buck 60.
Probably right.
Yeah. It was impressive. So, you know, this Raiders team, for as unknown generally as they are to East Coast viewers and even Central viewers because they're not on TV a whole lot, they're not a bad club.
Nope. We'll get to them. Now, hey, John Crockett, you won your bet on John Crockett.
I did.
John was inactive.
Yeah. No way. Don't mess with me on John Crockett, Bob. I know my John Crockett.
I thought John, no, I was dead wrong.
It's got to be because he can't contribute as well as they'd like on special teams, right?
I guess, yeah.
I would assume that's the reason. Right. Who was up instead, Backman?
Backman and Ripkowski.
Well, Rip's been up almost every game.
Mm, yeah.
But Backman hasn't, so I would assume maybe it was Backman's spot.
Yep, right.
But speaking, going back to that running game a little bit, what did you think of you know, we've seen Starks in a lead back capacity, and now we sort of saw him as the true supplement, both catching the ball and running the ball, and it seemed like it was about as perfect of a split and a blend of those two styles as this team could have.
I agree with you all the way. This is, you know, when it was going good the last 2 years, this is the way it was. You know, Mike Starks had a ton of injuries his first 4 years before you got here. And then now he's been healthy for a year and a half, you know. And he's a good player. And he's a different kind of back. And that's what McCarthy's been talking about all along.
Were you as impressed as I was with the blocking of John Kuhn?
No.
No, okay.
Tell me what you saw.
Well, I saw, you know, obviously there were some plays where he missed and things like that, but I just thought, generally speaking, he did a good job of getting through the hole so that the first contact on his running backs, if they actually followed him the way the play was designed, wasn't until 3 or 4 yards downfield.
Okay, yeah.
I thought that was good. But maybe, you know, if you disagree, that's fine. But what about just generally his usage? He had more snaps than Richard Rodgers.
Yeah, he did. He had 44 snaps. His career high is 45 in that Seattle Hail Mary game in 2012.
And earlier I checked out the snap counts. He had 3 games with 10 or fewer snaps since the bye week. So this was a major change.
Yeah. You know, there's some, in some ways, when you look at that Dallas front, they're undersized. Nick Hayden, the nose tackle, is really a pumped-up 295-pound guy. He played at the Badgers. He's from the state. He's a smaller nose. There's no question. Tyrone Crawford has good size as a three-tech, but I see him more as a penetrator than a hold-a-point guy. The Gregory and Lawrence, we mentioned them. They're 260, 250. Now, Greg Hardy's got good size, but, you know, Sean Lee, you want to run right at Sean Lee. He's 238, I think it is. Okay. Now, Rolando McClain's huge, but I think McCarthy saw those matchups, and to his credit, he tried to exploit it with more of a straight-ahead ground game.
Am I crazy to have a little bit of an interest in just seeing what Ripkowski could do on offense?
No, I think I would, too.
Yeah.
He's a smart kid, but he just doesn't have all this experience that Kuhn does.
Agreed. Let's go to another youngster. How impressive was Jeff Janis?
Yeah, so I wrote the story on him. People kid us about writing a lot about the guy. I mean, he's made big plays in Minnesota. I wrote about him after that game, and he made huge plays. I mean, as Chris Banjo said, you know, Jarrett Bush, before your time, Mike, but Jarrett did this stuff for 9 or 10 years, and he really did. But three minuses in one game, I don't think Jarrett ever did that. I don't think I've ever seen this. Three solo tackles, all
split,
for minus yardage.
He split
yardage.
One with Goodson. He split the last
Janis
one with
did it, though.
I'm just telling you what the stat
okay.
sheet says.
Yeah.
He split it with Goodson.
And then he forced another fair catch.
Yep.
Against some kind of a strange-looking double team.
Yeah, really weird double team.
After the first one. So, he's a force.
I still think, and I asked him about this once, I still think that regardless of what he's shown on tape as a kick returner, regardless of the fleeting reps that he's gotten on offense, I still think opposing teams don't anticipate him to be that fast. That's the only thing I can think of when he just runs by guys, that they look at him, and they see him, and they say, this is a big guy, this is a strong guy, I've never heard of him, he played at some tiny school that I've never heard of, he can't run by me, and then he does.
And that's what Quentin Rollins was telling me Sunday after the game, you know, that a wide receiver, a white guy, I mean, let's face it, you yeah. don't see a whole lot of white gunners. He's tall, he looks like, you know, they think he's white, he can't run. Saginaw Valley State, they may know that, 7th-round pick. But he's done enough on tape where these guys shouldn't be fooled at this point. Now, yep. if this was week 2 or 3 or something. So, yeah, I mean, he's really doing it. He's a worthy successor to Jarrett Bush.
What did, you know, Rollins is another guy that is new to that gunner position this season. What did he have to say about Janis and just the way he's developed on special teams?
Well, he just talked about how people ignored or disregard Janis because of those other factors. That's about all he said. Banjo was saying that he said we would have been talking about this earlier, but Janis missed a few tackles in those kind of situations. And I guess he did. I can remember a few, maybe.
I can remember one or two.
Yeah. Banjo said that now he's going to see a lot of attention after this game. He said the Raiders are really going to be doubling him.
And Monday, in his press conference, Ron Zook said that they're a team that does a really good job jamming gunners anyway, from what he said. He said one of the better jobs he's seen this season. So
they're coached by Brad Seeley, who's been doing this almost 30 years. He's got 3 or 4 Super Bowl rings. He's one of the best. So he'll see Janis, and he won't be disregarding him.
Well, we mentioned it briefly, but you know, let's get back into really what the meat of Sunday's game was, which was the change at play calling. You know, Mike McCarthy cedes those responsibilities in February after last season ends. He gives the job to Tom Clements, his associate head coach on offense, and Clements goes and takes us through the first 12 games. Obviously, some disappointment, some stagnation, a lack of production on offense. And on Sunday, about 11:45 a.m., the news breaks that McCarthy is taking back the play calling. First, were you surprised? And second, did you think it was going to happen?
I wasn't surprised. I thought it should have been happening all along.
Okay.
I mean, I wrote in February that he never should have done it. But I did think it was going to happen earlier. But he just apparently, you know, he knew Aaron Rodgers would be disappointed, his quarterback, because of how close he is to Clements. He knew Clements would be crushed, obviously, because this is a career chance for a very loyal and capable assistant coach, especially at coaching quarterbacks. I mean, McCarthy did a lot with Rodgers, but this is the day-to-day stuff that Clements did to develop that player. But he finally did it, and better late than never.
One of the questions I got a lot on Twitter and in the chat after the game was, okay, if Clements is not calling the plays, does that mean he's likely to be let go during the offseason? And I don't know the answer to that, but my first inclination was, why are we assuming that this guy is going to get let go? He's been on the staff for a long time, and this was the very first time he called the plays. That means the other years he was on the staff, he was doing other things and had other responsibilities and contributed in other ways. So it's not as if this guy was brought in to call the plays, just call the plays, and then they get rid of him. I mean, he did other things for this offense, right?
Right. He's involved in the game planning stuff. He's recommending stuff to McCarthy now. I mean, he could go back to coaching quarterbacks, and then Van Pelt could do the wide receivers rather than doing both. There's all kinds of roles they could do with Clemens. But I would be highly surprised if Tom Clemens wasn't on the staff next year.
Yeah, my thoughts exactly. And McCarthy basically said, you know, this is a guy that's been with us for a lot of years, been part of a lot of success, and he will continue to be, you know, part of the success.
Now, Tom Clemens might want to leave.
Sure.
After this, certainly. And at that point, I don't think Mike McCarthy would stand in his way. That wouldn't be fair, certainly. So, I mean, Clemens would be looking for an OC job somewhere, yep. Or who knows, a head coaching job in the NFL or in college football. I guess that stuff's a little late, but even a quarterback job somewhere else where he could groom a young QB.
Now, after the game, McCarthy was asked if he would continue to call the plays the rest of the season, and I was a little bit surprised at his answer in one regard, but not so much in another. McCarthy basically said that he would call the plays against Oakland, but it would kind of be a week-to-week, we're going game-to-game type thing, and I get that. You know, one of the things that they always say is it's a one-week season for 17 weeks, you know what I mean? And the other part of me said, okay, he probably just doesn't want to come out and say, oh yeah, I'm doing it the rest of the season, and really stick it to Tom in that regard, and saying, well, I did better one game, so no chance it goes back to him. But do you think there's any possibility at all that he could revert back to Clemens this season?
No.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's McCarthy the rest of the way.
You know, Mike, you read transcripts of these people in the NFL, all 32 teams. Nobody ever wants to say anything emphatically or decisively. You notice how they drop the word probably in constantly? They drop the words a little bit. They'll say something and it's a little bit. They want to reduce the impact of everything they say. It's, what would some of these words be? Obfuscation, obtuseness.
Well,
it's just crazy.
Escape valves, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Ways to cover your tracks, all those kinds of things.
Like somebody, you'll read a transcript, somebody might make a fairly declarative sentence, and then it'll tail off into a little bit. They'll add this.
Right.
So I think McCarthy was doing that. I mean, he does it all the time. Everybody does it. It's just not him. It's a little frustrating covering the league when you run into this.
A little bit.
In every interview you have, virtually. So I don't know. He's being paid at least $8 million for his expertise. And he's a good motivator. He's won a Super Bowl. He's won a lot of games. He's been in the playoffs 6 straight years, and his main areas of expertise are coaching quarterbacks and calling plays, designing an offense and calling plays. And all of a sudden, he's not doing what he does best. Now, to me, that makes no sense. It made no sense back in February, and to this day, it makes no sense. This is a guy. So what does he do with the rest of his time? He told us he was sitting in on special teams meetings. He has no expertise in special teams. I'm sure he's picked some up now in the last 10 months. He's sitting in on Dom Capers' defensive meetings. Okay, he can help Dom. He's attacked defenses his whole life. But again, he does not know anything about formulating a defensive plan, when to blitz, all these kind of things. He knows something about it. It's not rocket science, but that is not his area. And how do you think those coaches felt with the head coach all of a sudden? I mean, you don't know how they felt, but the guess is probably not that great. These are professional veteran coordinators. Analytics. Okay. He's heavily involved in analytics. Administrative duties. More time to talk to players, more times to stop in the equipment room, more time to go in the locker room. I'm sure all that stuff is fairly important.
I'm sure it pays dividends in some regard. A little bit.
But I know what his area of expertise is, a little bit. And his area of expertise, if we've just been through all this, Tom Clemens has not called plays since Buffalo. And at that point in Buffalo, I think it was Mike Mularkey decided to make a change at midseason, maybe his last year in Buffalo, just like McCarthy's done now. Better late than never.
Here's my question. Let's flip the script a little bit. if you're Oakland and you're the defensive coaches in Oakland, what, if anything, is different about your preparation now that McCarthy's calling plays? Are they going back and looking at old tape to try and dig up tendencies and things that are now irrelevant with Clements from the first 12 games?
I think there is enough time and enough people on NFL staffs now to do that.
I agree.
These quality control guys, Mike, it's a good point.
All those videos and things, the tablets, everything. I think it could be done pretty quickly, actually.
In-house, they have Reggie McKenzie and Sean Harrock, who, you know, were here for years and years, most of the McCarthy years. Defensive coaches are talking to those guys about all this. Yeah, I think there is time.
Whereas Dallas obviously wouldn't have had enough time in 2 hours to figure anything out. They just rolled with what they had and went with it.
That's right. Rod Marinelli's coached many times against McCarthy, but still, he was surprised when that report came on TV, right?
So it'll be interesting to see if the Oakland defense does anything very different, just prepping for McCarthy.
McCarthy's very good at this part of the game. I mean, he just is. He's got a feel. You saw how rapid paced he was getting those things in. I mean, it was just...
Would they run 81 plays?
Yeah. And he's just on it. He's just calling these things. He's a very confident guy in this part of his profession. He should be. He's done it well for a lot of places, you know? I mean, that's how he got this job, you know, the head coaching job, what he did with the Saints.
And one of the things I really liked was, and that's not to say there wasn't examples of this with Clements, I'm sure there were, but I was obviously focusing more on the offense when I went back and watched the tape on Monday. I thought there was a really good little bit of what I would call sequential play calling on one drive late in the game. And I don't know if that's what McCarthy calls it or other coaches call it, but what I meant was early in the drive, they ran a run play with Lacy to the left side. And it required tight end Richard Rodgers to line up on the right, come across the formation, which is called a wham block, and go on to the left side and block for Lacy in the direction the play was supposed to be run. Three snaps later, they ran what looked like an identical play, but it was a play fake to Lacy, and instead of Richard Rodgers executing a block, he slipped the block on Greg Hardy, and it set up a screen pass. Now, the play was eventually nullified by a pass interference penalty on James Jones away from the ball. But to me, that was something that was kind of interesting because you saw within a span of three plays, McCarthy deliberately setting up a defense and then taking advantage of what he had just set up with a play-action pass that looked almost exactly the same. And those are kind of just like a little nugget that jumped out to me when I watched the tape.
Good call, Mike. Yep.
Now, I don't know if, and who's to say Clements wasn't doing that earlier in the season? I don't know. He certainly could have been. But that was a little breadcrumb that I noticed.
Yep. Gotcha.
Anything else we want to talk about from the Cowboys?
We talked about the O-line.
We did the O-line. We did Janis.
The D-line, nothing really happened there. They didn't have much pass rush, Green Bay.
No, but Matthews got that one vicious sack. Boy, he hit Castle hard, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
You ever take a shot like that? Unblocked linebacker right through the middle?
I try to forget it. It's not easy keeping those eyes downfield.
I guess
that's
not.
That's why these guys are where they are, man.
That's why they get paid a lot of money.
Yes, sir.
All right, well, we will take a short break, and we'll hear from our sponsor, and then we'll come back and shift gears, take a look at the Oakland Raiders.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
All right, let's move on to the scouting report of the Oakland Raiders. What do we got, Bob?
The Raiders are a different team than the Packers have seen it for many a year. When the Packers got good in 92, they've only played five times. And in those five games, the Packers 5-0, 93, 99, 03, 07, and 11, they've outscored them. They've won the games by an average of 25.4 points, outgained them 137.8.
Wow.
Favre for four and Rodgers for one. Who are the Raiders starters at QB? Jeff Hostetler.
How many different ones are there?
Five games, five starters.
Gannon?
Yes, he's second. Rick Meyer.
Okay.
He was a Packer for a bit. A little bit. Josh McCown and Carson Palmer 4 years ago.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Carson threw four picks that day.
I was going to guess Bruce Gradkowski. I think he started for them as an injured backup for a while.
coming off the bench in those five games were Vince Evans, Rob Johnson, who won a Super Bowl, Mr. T. Martin, and Andrew Walter of Michigan Tech University.
Okay.
Andrew Walter. All right, so Reggie McKenzie in the 2014 draft, the former Packers scout, who you don't know, Mike, now the GM of the Raiders. Blake Bortles, Johnny Manziel, and Teddy Bridgewater were gone. But with that 36th pick in the second round, he took Mr. Derek Carr.
Derek was Devontae Adams' quarterback for a little while, right?
Mm-hmm. Carr has started all 29 games. His passer rating right now is like 95.6 or something. He was 76.6 last year. And he gives them a chance.
Yep.
This is the best hope at young quarterback since Kenny Stabler in the early 70s. So Carr gives them a shot, and they're 6-7. They're not eliminated, and that's what they got. Let's talk about Carr for a second. Everybody you talk to, Mike, he's got an extremely rapid release. The ball is out. He's only been sacked, I think, 19 times.
His
line is not that good. No, this season.
Oh, this season. I was going to say.
And it's not a great line. He can run. He ran 4.69. He gets it out. And he's a pretty tough guy. Now, the way to beat him, teams have found this, they think you can rattle him with blitzes up the middle. So he'll see a lot of that from Clay Matthews and Jake Ryan and whatever. Ball security is an issue with Carr, too, but he's a good player. Now, he's had a couple rough games in a row. He had 3 fourth-quarter picks against the Chiefs 2 weeks ago, and he didn't play good in Denver. All right, his weapons. He's got good weapons. McKenzie's done a great job changing this around. Amari Cooper, the fourth pick in this year's draft, he's a tremendous deep threat, 4.35 speed, really good double moves, sleek, smart, 21 years old. This guy is going to be, he's not Odell Beckham, but he's moving up into that realm.
Yep.
Michael Crabtree, a kind of a Packer killer for the Niners in those playoff games 3, 4, 5 years ago. Crabtree got hurt, had a bad year last year with San Francisco. They got rid of him, let him walk. Raiders signed him for a middle-tier contract. He's been terrific.
He's been really good for them.
He's got strong, sure hands. He's not a burner, but he's just been a really good player.
His numbers in college at Texas Tech, I mean, I know that's kind of one of those gimmicky systems that people, but I mean, I remember games where he had 20 receptions.
Yes.
Unreal.
In 2009, the Packers had the number 9 pick. Yeah. And it was going to come down to Raji or Crabtree. Hmm. And even though they had receivers, I advocated that they should have taken Crabtree just because how good he was.
Yeah.
And they took Raji, and that's been fine, and Crabtree's been fine too. So.
Sure.
Okay, the number 3. They have Andre Holmes and Rod Streeter have both been starters for the last 3 years at times, caught quite a bit of balls. I mean, these guys have made plays. They can't get on the field because of this Seth Roberts, a 6'2", second-year free agent from West Alabama.
Wow, okay.
5 touchdowns among 27 catches, I think. He can run. He's pretty decent. I mean, he beat Bradley Roby on kind of a post corner for a touchdown the other day. Beautiful route.
Doesn't usually happen to men from the Ohio State University.
At least not Mr. Bradley Roby. Okay, tight end. This is another plus. Lee Smith plays a lot of snaps. He's a nasty, old-fashioned blocker.
Okay.
Personally, I like having a guy like that, and I think Green Bay could use a guy like that. I've been on that soapbox for a long time. But no, they'd rather... Okay. Michael Rivera has caught 123 balls in his career for the Raiders. He's not real fast, but he's kind of sneaky, and he's all right. But the real key is Clive Walford. Third-round pick from Miami. Missed almost all training camp with a hamstring. The guy has really come on the last 5 games. He hurt the Broncos deep. Tremendous catch in his fingertips down the seam. The guy does not have great, great speed, 4.75, but he has a way to maximize it, and he's a threat. He's why people considered him among the top 3 tight ends in the draft last year. Good player. He's a threat. You got to worry about him.
How about the backs?
Latavius Murray got the job late last year. He's a 6th-round pick from where? Central Florida, I believe. Let's check that out, Mike. Yeah, UCF. He's in a bit of a slump. He's a kind of a strider. He looks a little bit like a poor man's Eric Dickerson. He's 6'2.5". He might be the tallest back in the league. He's not really anything special. I thought he was better than this. He's just okay. They got two other guys who play a lot. Don't know how to pronounce this. Jamiz Olawale. They just signed him to an extension last week. This guy's about 240. He ran 4.52 coming out of North Texas. He's a tremendous...
Jumaze Olawale, says the pronunciation guide. I would not have guessed that one.
Cool. Jumaze. Jumaze can run, and he can catch, and he can block. He's a combination running back, fullback. He's a good player. Marcel Reese has been around there for 7 years. He's kind of a receiver, runner. He's okay. The O-line, they've changed that around, too, in the last 2 years. Donald Penn is the left tackle, a former Buccaneer, longtime starter. Bad body, plays a lot better than his body looks. He's not bad. Gabe Jackson, a third-round pick in 2014, he's the left guard. Like 340 out of Florida State, correct. Can't run, 5'5", need a sundial to time him. Guy's pretty good run blocker.
A sundial?
Yeah.
Where'd you come up with that one? Which scout used that before on you?
Yeah. And he's pretty good in pass pro, too. All right, they paid a lot of money to get Rodney Hudson away from the Chiefs. He's the center. Undersized, 6'2.5". They paid a lot of money for this guy. Tony Bergstrom is a pretty good backup, too. But they wanted Hudson. He's got a lot of football intelligence. He's pretty strong for his size. He's quick. He's a technician. He holds it together. All right, now the other two spots. They were going to start Menelik Watson at right tackle, and he blew his Achilles in August. That was a serious blow. He could have been their best player. They would have really had a good line with him. All right, so what they did, they took Austin Howard, a former Jet, a massive guy, put him from right guard to right tackle. He's got a knee injury, might not play. He got hurt against Denver. That would be Khalif Barnes coming in there. He's got 121 career starts. He's not as good as Howard, but he's okay. He's right near the end. The right guard, it's kind of shocking. People in the NFC North will remember Jamarcus Webb. He started at left tackle for the Bears for a while, the Vikings for a while. Now he's playing guard. Now, Webb and Howard are 6'7.5", right around 330. They're like two houses on their right side, according to a scout.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah. Webb, you can get underneath Webb. I could see Mike Daniels doing a lot of damage against this guy. They're not very good on the right side, and it's a problem.
Did you see, speaking of guys getting leverage, did you see that play against the Cowboys where B.J. Raji actually started on his knees?
Yes.
What was that about?
Well, in goal line situations, they tell you to get really, really, really low. But
you can't get any push because it's not your foot. You can't push off a knee, really.
But at least you're going to have low ground.
Well, yeah.
It was a little strange.
It was weird.
Yeah.
It didn't work, and it did not work either.
No,
it was just
they went the other way, didn't they? Yeah. All right, so that's the offense. Carr's in the middle of growing pains. He's not there yet. He can be blitzed. The running game is not real good. I like the receivers. I like their tight end mix right now. Three of the offensive linemen are pretty good. They're a 6-7 team for a reason, but, they're okay.
All right, let's go to the defense.
All right, so this is Jack Del Rio, coordinated now by former Seahawk linebacker coach Ken Norton, first-time coordinator. So you look at it, and you think it's a 3-4 the way they line up, Mike, but you could also call it a 4-3 under defense. It's a little confusing. They're pretty tough. It's not a bad unit. I don't know where they are in yards. They're 25th in yards, 23rd in points. So it's not great, but it's okay. All right, let's look at the front. The right end is Mario Edwards, a high second-round pick this year, a rookie.
Florida State, right?
Yeah. Dad was a cornerback for the Cowboys. He's a pretty darn good player.
Okay.
He's had a good year. It's a good draft pick. He plays a lot standing up in this thing. He puts his hand down and goes to DT on passing downs. He's probably their second-best rusher. I like him. The other end in base is Denico Autry. Now, Denico, I talked to him about two or three days after the 2014 draft because he had agreed to terms with the Packers on a free agent deal. Something happened because when they started rookie orientation camp, he wasn't there. And then he signed with the Raiders 4 or 5 days later. I don't know if he flunked the physical, presumably he did, or I don't know, or he reneged on the deal, not really sure. Autry, 11 5/8-inch hands.
Wow.
I've hardly ever heard of 11 5/8.
What's Barkley?
Oh, yeah. 10 7/8 or something.
So this is significantly bigger.
Yeah. Long arms, too. And, you know, for a free agent from Mississippi State, the guy's pretty good. He can't run 5.07. You see him slashing around against Denver. A scout said he saw him making some plays earlier in the year. He's a pretty good free agent player.
Okay.
He's not great, but he's a decent. All right, then they got the massive rhinos on the interior. You got Dan Williams.
You have houses on the O-line and rhinos on the defensive line.
Dan Williams came from Arizona for pretty good change. He's been a starter there for 5 years. He's not bad. He's pretty good three-techer, nose. They're all kind of interchangeable. Justin Ellis was a third-round pick from La Tech, I believe it was. Correct. He adds ballast. This guy, Leon Orr, a rookie free agent from Florida State. Based on talent, he would have been a draft pick. He was a very bad boy down in Florida. Very bad. Nobody would touch him. Well, the Raiders took him as a free agent, and they promoted him from the practice squad just last week. He looked really good against Denver. He's got a ton of talent. Everybody knew that. It's just if you could keep him on the straight and narrow. Stacy McGee, another big guy from Oklahoma, a young player, plays. And Shelby Harris, who played at Homestead High School briefly for the Badgers. I made a mistake, and it was pointed out by a reader today in that scouting report. I said Shelby only played, was on the team for four games but hadn't played. That's incorrect. He's played 73 snaps in four games. So he's a guy, he's got a checkered past, but the Raiders, Reggie McKenzie, has had this guy back and forth for 2 years now, and he must like him. He's got something to offer. He's a big guy with talent, no doubt. So that's their front, a bunch of big guys.
What about the backers, where they used, you know, one of their top, was it number 5 overall pick?
Yeah. On Khalil Mack.
From Buffalo.
So he plays primarily the left side. You could call him he's in the Julius Peppers role or a 4-3 Sam backer. All right, he leads the league in sacks with 14. 40-inch vert, runs 4.57, strong, 255, 260. He wore Denver out. 5 sacks, all in the second half. The longest was 3.3 seconds. I charted these things. 4 against Michael Schofield and 1 against that Harris guy on the left tackle. Now, they did not, they weren't helping him. They tried to help on the last two. Mack beat him anyway. The guy's going to be charging every darn time, and both tackles got to be ready, primarily Balaga.
Better than what you expected when you looked at him in the draft? The draft series, I mean?
Yeah. He came from University of Buffalo.
So did James Starks now.
Correct. That's his only scholarship offer.
Really?
Mack, yeah. He came out of a small school in Florida. Fell through the cracks. Okay, the middle backer, they paid money to get Curtis Lofton, the old Falcon Saint, 100% multi-purpose middle backer. Leader, good tackler.
I remember watching him at Oklahoma in college. He was a good player.
Oklahoma, yeah, okay. All right, now they tried to play Lofton with Malcolm Smith in their nickel, both of them 100%. Malcolm's the old Seahawk who really runs fast, MVP of the Super Bowl. Somehow that happened. I don't know. It was a crazy pick, man. I didn't have anything to do with that pick. Anyway, Curtis Lofton, he's lost speed, and they have to remove him now in passing downs. And the last 2 weeks they've gone with Ben Heaney, kind of a talented fifth-round pick. Rookie, runs pretty good. He's undersized, but he's a lot faster than Lofton, and he brings energy. All right, now in the secondary, that would be their weakness. You got David Amerson, a gambling guy from NC State, started for the Redskins for about almost 2 full years. Redskins cut him. New GM Scott McLuhan, new regime. They cut him in September. Raiders, as hard up as they were, claimed him on waivers. He's their best cover guy, Mike. He's physical. He's got swag. I have not seen him give up a whole lot of gambles right now, but that's what the Green Bay will be trying to do, double move him. That's his deal. He's a ball hawk, and he loses control. The other corner is T.J. Carey, another really good athlete. Well, let's just combine all these guys. Nico Thorpe is the nickel, and D.J. Hayden is the dime. All four of these guys, they're not great, but they're big, and they're physical, and they bump you, and if it's being called their way, they kind of did some damage to the Broncos.
Does not bode well for the strengths of this Packers receiving corps, sounds like. Big, physical, and bumping you at the line of scrimmage seems to be
what is...
But
they're not that good, though, Mike.
Okay, but that's what's given the Packers problems.
They're not that skillful.
Okay.
You know? The Pack can double move these folks.
Okay.
All right. If they're on their game. Okay. Charles Woodson is the starting safety. Woodson's playing through a bad shoulder injury. He's, what, 38, 39?
Sounds about right.
Yeah. You know, he's trying to be the glue of the thing. He's near the end, obviously, but he's still playing, and he's still enjoying it. He's got to. He's not making all that much money, like not what he did in Green Bay. But he loves the game. All right. The safety, they'd like to have it be Nate Allen, but the old Eagle, he's a competent starter, but he's got a knee. He may not play. So that could mean Taylor Mays. Second-round pick of the Niners, I guess, 6 years ago. Great, great athlete, great speed.
Do you play at USC?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Okay.
He's been cut. He's been to like, well, I don't even know, 7-8 teams maybe.
Wow.
Everybody tries him. Everybody cuts him. He just can't really play the game. He's, you know, lacks change of direction, coverage ability, but he will hit. He's 235, but he can be exploited. And then in some sub situations, Carey might move back to safety. He's got enough size, and he's done that quite a bit.
Okay, what do they have on teams?
They're good. They got a good coordinator in Brad Seeley. They got a good, really good punter in Marquette King,
mm-hmm.
who really pinned the Broncos back. Sebastian Janikowski, the old sidewinder, he slipped. Like, I don't even know if he intentionally is mishitting his kickoffs now, but he just, like, bangs them, you know, that they hit it about the 15 and they're just going 100 miles an hour and there's no hang time. They're like, you know, worm rapers, we used to call them.
We call them worm burners.
Yeah, okay.
Like, but your drives on the golf course, Bob. Yeah. The worm burner never gets off the ground.
And his field goals have been a little erratic, too. They got a problem at long snapper, Mike.
Really?
Yeah. John Kondo, well, how many years has he been doing this? 9 years. He recovered a fumble on a punt, and he dislocated his shoulder.
Wow.
He sat out one snap, came back to make three, had a bad snap on a bad missed field goal. No idea if they're going to stick with him or not. I haven't seen a roster move yet, but that's a problem. The backup, Lee Smith, the tight end, has got a busted hand. He's playing with that, so that's not real good. All right, the dual kickoff returner is an old Packer, Jeremy Ross. I like Jeremy. He hurt the Packers when he was in Detroit. I think he's a north-south guy. He's got average speed. He will put the ball on the ground. In fact, he did it once for the Raiders already this year, on a punt. Tywan Jones is an amazingly fast running back. He's their best core player. That's the Raiders, 6-7. They're a 3-point dog at the OCO Coliseum, one of the armpits of the NFL.
I can't say I've ever covered a football game in a stadium where there's going to be dirt on the field, right?
Not anymore.
Baseball diamond?
They
sod it. Okay, but early in the season, they leave it with the dirt, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a pit, Mike. It's supposed to rain torrentially.
It is supposed to rain all
weekend.
Friday,
Saturday, Sunday.
All weekend.
It could be a quagmire. The place has got a bad surface to begin with. It could be a muddy mess.
It's nothing the Packers aren't used to their last two home games.
Hey, they play on DD Grassmaster.
Well, I'm just saying, what do we have on Thanksgiving and what do we have this past weekend? Pouring rain.
Wet DD Grassmaster. I hear you.
Pouring rain. Well, we just finished talking about the special teams, and let's kind of transition a little bit to a story that I wrote last week about some of the more quirky plays that a team practices. And I kind of got this idea after watching the, well, obviously the Hail Mary against the Lions, and then listening to Mike McCarthy's press conference after, you know, X number of questions about the Hail Mary. He just kind of got sick of it and said, look, guys, it's situational football. We practice this stuff. And, of course, he's right. You know, it is situational football. But it was also meant as a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment to say, like, hey, look at this. This is what we work on all the time, don't you know? And then it kind of got me wondering, what are some other things that lurk in the corners of a playbook that that teams don't really show very often? So I went around to different guys in the locker room, and I just sort of asked them. I said, hey, what are some of the weirdest plays that you guys work on? And naturally, the best answers came on special teams. The two plays that they identified, Bob, one, an onside kick after a safety, which happened to the Packers 2 years ago against the Lions, and a fair catch kick. Now, of the 53 guys in that room, and let's expand it. Let's say of the 63 guys, count the practice squad. How many of the 63 could explain to you what a fair catch kick was correctly? What do you think?
Two or three.
I say no more than five.
Okay.
I bet Rodgers could do it. I bet Mastay and Crosby could do it.
I bet Chris Banjo could.
Yeah. So that's four. Well, maybe it's a little more than five.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I asked Dimitri Goodson, and you know, he kind of gave me a description of the play, but he didn't remember what it was called. He kept saying, he's like, you know, I can't even remember the name of it. It's like this weird thing at the end of the half where it's like a safety, but you can kick the ball through the uprights, and if you can reach it, it's worth points. And I said, you mean like a fair catch kick? And he's like, yeah, that's what it's called. That's what it's called. So, I mean, here's one of their core special teams players who's done a great job for them on teams over the, you know, the course of his career, and he couldn't even remember this. Have you ever seen one in a game that you've covered? There haven't been many.
I believe one.
Okay.
And I think there was a stoppage of play. The team was considering doing it. The team was on the field. And then I think they pulled back and tried a Hail Mary or something.
Okay.
Where, when, I don't know.
I kind of, when I was reading about it, obviously I went back to the rule book so that I got the verbiage correct and everything. I kind of wondered why it doesn't happen more. Because, like, Crosby, he can hit a 60-yard field goal, right?
Yeah.
So with no rush and with a free run up at it, I mean, he kicks kickoffs. Why couldn't he hit one from 70?
So all that would take would be a fair catch on the 40-yard line.
A fair catch on the 40-yard line, which is not unusual.
You spot the ball right there.
Spot the ball right there. The rush can't come within 10 yards of you. They start 10 yards away.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's they can't move.
They can scream bloody murder at you.
They can scream bloody murder at you, but it's just... It's as if you and I went out to a high school field, you put the ball down, and I tried to kick it. And that's what it is. And I mean, I'm not saying that it would happen every game, but it did kind of surprise me that, you know, I can't remember the exact number, I put it in the story, but there was an article on SB Nation that said there'd only been about, what, 20-something of these ever in the NFL?
Really?
What did it say? Yeah, 21 times, according to SB Nation. So, and the most recent was in 2014, I believe, excuse me, 2013. Phil Dawson tried a 71-yarder with Harbaugh.
He tried it, huh?
Yeah, it shanked it.
What is SB Nation?
Oh, it's just a website, a sports website.
What's SB stand for? That's all right.
Sports blog? I don't know. Now you got me wondering.
Okay, Mike.
Anyway.
Can I tell you my first exposure to one of these free kick field goals?
Go for it. Sports Blog Nation. That's what I thought. Okay.
I think it was in 1964. And the Packers were playing the Bears early in the year. And my buddy and I were watching this game in Escanaba, Michigan, at his house. And we had no idea what was going on. But all of a sudden, there was Paul Hornung, right, lining up for a field goal at the end of the half. And I think he made it. I don't know. Now, you've had some, you know something about this now, right? About that kick?
Little.
Did he make it? Not sure.
I can't remember.
I think he attempted it. That's all I remember. That's the only thing. We had no idea what it was, obviously, but I never forgot it. That's how rare it was.
I'm trying to think. I got a bunch of emails about this. I think he did make it.
Okay.
I didn't have time to go back and look at it, and you know, people were asking why I didn't include that in the story, and it was because the story was focused on 2015, and any success that Lombardi had in the 60s would not in any way make the coaches today want to practice it. That's, you know, completely irrelevant. But
yep.
The one account that I got a voicemail, actually. This is what it was. I got a voicemail, and it was from a guy who is the ref in the Green Bay Basketball City League. He came up to me one day after a game, and he said, are you know, Michael Cohen from the Journal Sentinel? And I said, yes. And he said that he was from Milwaukee originally, now lives in Green Bay, but he's been a loyal Journal Sentinel reader. So I gave him my business card. Okay. And he called me and left me a message, and I got to call him back. I forgot about it. He said that he was actually at that game with his father, I believe. And his recollection, and again, I didn't have time to go back and check it, was that the fair catch kick was good. It made the score 31-0 at the half. And the way he remembered it was that they went on to win 31-28. So it proved to be the winning points, if that was true. But yeah, as it was explained to me by him and a couple of readers, he did make the kick.
Okay. Well, I also sort of think
Is there a video of that?
Yeah, there
there's
got to
be somewhere. Yeah?
Sure.
Yeah. I wonder if we could find it on YouTube.
I also think a bear kicker, Mac Percival, might have attempted one against the Packers. That's vaguely in the recesses of the memory.
Hmm.
What's the best way to refer that?
Fair catch kick.
Fair catch kick.
That's what it's listed as in the rule book.
Okay. Did you read the rule book?
Yes. I tried.
Yeah.
Let's see. It doesn't come up on YouTube as being any footage anywhere. Oh, here we go. What does it say on?
Fair catch kick.
Yeah, Wikipedia, again, take it with a grain of salt. First thing that comes up says, Paul Hornig kicked one from 52 yards good as time expired in the second quarter against the Chicago Bears. It doesn't say the outcome of the game.
What's the date?
September 13th, 1964. And believe it or not, there was another one the exact same day. How crazy is that? According to this Wikipedia article, in an Eagles-Giants game, Sam Baker missed one from 47 yards. Two
right,
in the same day.
And there's my Mac Percival.
Mac Percival, Bears-Packers.
Yeah.
Mac hit it from 43 yards with 20 seconds left in the fourth quarter. It was the game-winning field goal.
What's the date?
November 3, 1968. Good call, Bob.
That might have been Phil Bankston's first game.
Yeah, I got a number. I got a number of emails and things from readers, but I couldn't remember off the top of my head if they had said that Hornig made it or missed it. But that phone call jogged my memory a little bit.
Any more involving the Packers? Look at that list on Wikipedia. Yes, there's one.
Mason Crosby attempted one, apparently. A 69-yarder in 2008. Ball hit the crossbar. I don't remember that, do you?
No, I do not.
Well, you've seen a lot of games.
I remember them when I was a kid, and I don't remember them as an adult, you know?
And then they were involved in the very first one, according to this as well. George Abramson, in 1925, hit one from 35 yards in the fourth quarter. The game was played in snow on a muddy field, says Wikipedia. And they were involved in the next one, too. What is with the Packers and these fair catch kicks, Bob? They're involved in, like, seven of these. And there's only got to be about 20 or so on this list. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Well, that was a fun story. I enjoyed writing that.
It was, yeah. Good read, Mike.
But let's, I want to touch base a little bit on a story that you wrote as well. A column from December 13th on Clay Matthews. We'll touch on this, you know, kind of briefly here. How'd you come up with this idea?
Well, every year around this time, I look at the draft for our readers. And so I did this big position thing with, I don't even know, five scouts, I guess it was, there were so many, I can't even remember. And it was a long week. And so then the accompanying column, what the Packers might be looking at in the draft themselves, you know, give the readers all these names and what's out there late in the college season, and then looking at the Packer needs. And I think the key is what to do with Clay Matthews. Personally, I think he's better as an outside backer. I see what Khalil Mack did, these outside guys. They're hard to find. These people are worth their weight in gold. Inside backers are not so hard to find. They're not worth their weight in gold. I just think Matthews is should go back outside and force this organization to get better inside, whether it's Ryan, Barrington. There's some really good inside backers in the draft this year. You got to get that in the first or second round. Get it done. Get Matthews back where he can make maximum impact.
So do the Packers become a better team if he moves outside?
Yes. Now, they have to have reasonable alternatives inside.
So,
but they're getting thin on the outside, too.
So would it be...
Very thin.
So would it, let's just sort of put the ball on the court now. I mean, you mentioned the draft, but let's kind of apply this to the present. Would it be a disaster if Ryan and Palmer played inside and then you move Matthews outside tomorrow?
Yes.
Why?
Because there's a huge drop-off there.
Okay.
You can't have those two guys starting.
So you think they need to go get somebody? Or
Barrington's back.
So could they play Barrington and Ryan?
Don't know.
It's still a weakness.
We don't know what Barrington's going to look like coming back from the injury. Yeah. We don't know what Ryan will do with a year in the weight room entering his second season. But they've got to get another player there, certainly. And that other player could be a first-round pick. I mean, there's players there now. Second-round pick. I mean, they bypassed a whole bunch of them this year. There's some guys playing pretty good. That was their call, and they went elsewhere. You know, they went to the cornerbacks. Their pass rush has been all right because of scheme this year, primarily. Capers doing some things. Clay Matthews on the outside, he's kind of plateaued to me playing the inside. He's okay, but he's a great outside linebacker. Period. Just like McCarthy, it's the same thing with McCarthy. Play him to his strengths. Do what you do best, man. Don't screw around with that. Okay, he took one for the team. The team needed him. It got him into the playoffs last year, all the way to the NFC title game, no question. It's helped their defense this year. They don't have enough at inside backer, especially Barrington was gone. But now on the outside, you got Peppers, another year older. I doubt Perry and Neal both will be back. Elliott, has he got enough in him to take a jump? Malumba's here. That's thin. That's almost as thin as inside.
I agree.
And outside is more important than inside.
In this scheme.
I believe it is, yep.
Yep. Yep.
All right, so that was the point of it, and then I went through all the other positions and whatnot.
Draft is going to be here before you know it, Bob.
It can wait.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll return and wrap this podcast up.
At Cannon and Dunphy, we're proud of our winning reputation. We're also proud to be the exclusive sponsor of the excellent Journal Sentinel coverage of our great football team. I'm Bill Cannon. To learn more about our winning team, go to our website.
All right, this is perhaps the longest podcast we've had since I got here, so we're going to make the questions portion a little quick. The first question comes from Paul Komorowski. Thanks for the question, Paul. Can the Packers realistically beat two out of the following three teams in the playoffs to reach Super Bowl 50? Seattle, Arizona, and Carolina. And or Carolina. What do you think, Bob?
Yes, they can. No question. Green Bay's got a lot of talent. Their injury situation's fine. They know how to win. They can get to the Super Bowl. They can win the Super Bowl.
And especially because it hasn't been determined yet what type of home field advantage they may or may not have. There's still a very legitimate chance that they could get home field throughout, or they could be on the road, you know?
Even if they don't, Mike, they won three in a row on the road in 2010.
Yep.
Home field, they've lost a bunch of home playoff games. That's not even a big factor. Michael, this is from Dane, Mr. Dane Shuda. And Dane writes, who has been the biggest disappointment this season and the most pleasant surprise?
Boy, that's a really good question. I mean, the easy cop-out answer, I guess, would be for disappointment would be Clements as a play caller. Clearly, it just didn't pan out. But that's, you know, more of a spur-of-the-moment type choice. But if you want to go with a biggest disappointment for a player, I still think you can put Randall Cobb in that situation. I think that Cobb, for the contract that he had, for the expectations he had, for the injury to Jordy Nelson and people counting on him, I just think he's really, really underachieved. And as you pointed out in your rating the Packers, I believe it might have been last week, not this most recent one, he might just not be an elite slot player.
Okay.
And then in terms of biggest surprise, I'm going to go Demarius Randall. I think that kid has had a heck of a rookie season. I think for him to come in and play is expected because you expect your first-round pick to contribute. I don't think you necessarily expect your first-round pick to win the starting corner job, to play in the base defense, to be an absolute rock in terms of confidence. And I just think, at least right now, they've swung and hit a good one with that one. You agree?
Good picks, Mike. Good picks.
Okay.
Anything
you'd want to add?
I want to add nothing.
Okay.
All I want to do is hear this song again. Michael, tell us about this choice.
Yeah, we forgot to discuss it at the top of the show, but this was Dancing in the Moonlight by King Harvest. You knew this one, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
And what was your?
I've always loved that song.
Yeah, when I played it on the laptop before we started recording, and Bob was walking around in the living room, and what did you say? Oh, that's a hell of a good song.
Yeah, no doubt.
Good song.
But Mike, that's way before you were on this earth. Well, how'd you know about this thing?
Well, it was. I've heard it plenty of times. There was a station growing up that my dad introduced me to on the radio, 102.9 FM in Connecticut. Big D 103. They played nothing but the 60s and 70s. Classics. The oldies station, if you will. And this was on there. And it was also, I think it was featured, let me see. And then obviously, I'd heard it a few times then, but I think it was also featured. No, I'm wrong. Okay, I thought it was in this movie soundtrack, but that's not the case. So yeah, it's just from something I've heard over the years. And we looked it up in, what book were you looking it up in to read a little about King Harvest?
That Billboard Top 40 book, which is put out by that guy down in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. He's got a country book and a rock book.
Okay.
Everything charted since the 50s. It's an outstanding book.
And where did Dancing in the Moonlight, check in?
It was their number, January of 73, they advanced, the highest was number 13 on the Billboard Top 40.
And that's the big one, not just the categorized one, right?
The big one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good tune.
Very.
All right, so we'll listen to a few more seconds of that.
All right.
You'll enjoy it, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Thank you.
See ya.
Everybody was dancing.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.